trio of Italian ladies who shared the hospital room with Holly imagined a lover's crise, and, placing the blame for her groanings where they felt it belonged, tut-tutted their tongues at me. I was flattered, proud that anyone should think Holly cared for me. She quieted when I offered her a cigarette. She swallowed and said, "Bless you, Buster, and bless you for being such a bad jockey. If I hadn't had to play Calamity Jane, I'd still be looking forward to the grub in an unwed mama's home. Strenuous exercise, that's what did the trick. But I've scared la merde out of the whole badge department by saying it was because Miss Dicaru slapped me. Yes, sir, I can sue them on several counts, including false arrest." Until then, we'd skirted mention of her more sinister tribulations, and this jesting reference to them seemed appalling, pathetic. "Now, Holly," I said, "we can't treat it as a joke. We have to make plans. You're too young to be stuffy, too small. By the way, what business is it of yours?" "Well, none, except you're my friend, and I'm worried. I mean to know what you intend doing." She rubbed her nose and concentrated on the ceiling. "Today's Wednesday, isn't it? So I suppose I'll sleep until Saturday. Saturday morning I'll skip out to the bank, then I'll stop by the apartment to pick up a nightgown or two, following which I'll report to Idlewild, where, as you damn well know, I have a perfectly fine reservation on a perfectly fine plane, and since you're such a friend, I'll let you wave me off. Please stop shaking your head. I'm not hot-footing after Jose, if that's what you suppose. It's only, why should I waste a perfectly fine ticket, already paid for? Besides, I've never been to Brazil." "Just what kind of pills have they been feeding you here? If they catch you jumping bail, they'll throw away the key. You're innocent. You've got to stick it out." "Oh, screw it," she said, and stabbed out her cigarette. "I have a fair chance they won't catch me, provided you keep your bouche fermée. Look, don't despise me, darling. I haven't much choice. I talked it over with the lawyer. Oh, I didn't tell him anything re-Rio. He tipped the Badgers himself rather than lose his fee. No, here's the real shake. All the Badgers want from me is a couple of free grabs and my services as a state's witness against Sally. Nobody has any intention of prosecuting me. Well, I may be rotten to the core, Maud, but testify against a friend I will not. My yardstick is how somebody treats me. An old Sally? All right, he took a slight advantage. Just the same, I'd let the fat woman snatch me sooner than help the law boys pin him down." A nurse, soft-shoeing into the room, advised that visiting hours were over. Holly started to complain and was curtailed by having a thermometer popped in her mouth. But as I took my leave, she unstoppered herself to say, "Do me a favor, darling. Call up the Times and get a list of the 50 richest men in Brazil. I'm not kidding. The 50 richest, regardless of race or color. Oh, another favor, poke around my apartment till you find that medal you gave me. The St. Christopher? I'll need it for the trip." The sky was red Friday night. It thundered. And Saturday, departing day, the city swayed in a squall-like downpour. Sharks might have swum through the air. It seemed improbable a plane could penetrate it. But Holly, ignoring my cheerful conviction that her flight would not go, continued her preparations, placing, I must say, the chief burden of them on me. For she had decided it would be unwise of her to come near the brownstone. So she'd gone from the hospital to a bank, and straight then to Joe Bell's bar.
"She don't figure she was followed,"
Joe Bell told me, when he came with a message that Holly wanted me to meet her there as soon as possible, a half hour at most, bringing
her jewelry, her guitar, toothbrushes and stuff, and a bottle of 100-year-old brandy. She says you'll find it hid down in the bottom of the dirty clothes basket. Yeah, oh, and the cat. She wants the cat.
Stumbling, skidding up and down the fire escape between Holly's apartment and mine, wind-blown and winded and wet to the bone, clawed to the bone as well, for the cat had not looked favorably upon evacuation, especially in such inclement weather, I managed a fast, first-rate job of assembling her going-away belongings. I even found the St. Christopher's medal. Everything was piled on the floor of my room. A poignant pyramid of brassieres and dancing slippers and pretty things I packed in Holly's only suitcase. There was a mass left over that I had to put in paper grocery bags. I couldn't think how to carry the cat until I thought of stuffing him in a pillowcase. Never mind why, but once I walked from New Orleans to Nancy's Landing, Mississippi, just under 500 miles. It was a light-hearted lark compared to the journey to Joe Bell's bar. The guitar filled with rain. Rain softened the paper sacks. The sacks split, and perfume spilled on the pavement. Pearls rolled in the gutter. While the wind pushed and the cat scratched, the cat screamed. But worse, I was frightened. Those storming streets seemed as warm with unseen presences waiting to trap, to imprison me for aiding an outlaw. The outlaw said,
"You're late, Buster. Did you bring the brandy? Mr. Bell, sir, 3 glasses."
"You'll only need 2, he told her. "I won't drink to your foolishness. If you're going to hell, you go on your own, with no further help from me."
An inaccurate statement, because seconds after he'd made it, a chauffeured limousine drew up outside the bar, and Holly, the first to notice it, put down her brandy, arched her eyebrows, as though she expected to see the district attorney himself alight. So did I. And when I saw Joe Bell blush, I had to think, by God, he did call the police. But then, with burning ears, he announced,
"It's nothing. One of them carry Cadillacs. I hired it to take you to the airport."
He turned his back on us to fiddle with one of his flower arrangements. Holly said,
"Kind, dear Mr. Bell. Look at me, sir."
He wouldn't. He wrenched the flowers from the vase and thrust them at her. They missed their mark, scattered on the floor.
"Goodbye," he said,
and as though he were going to vomit, scurried to the men's room. The Carey chauffeur was a worldly specimen who accepted our slapdash luggage most civilly and remained rock-faced when, as the limousine swished uptown through a lessening rain, Holly stripped off her clothes, the riding costume she'd never had a chance to substitute, and struggled into a slim black dress. We didn't talk. Holly seemed too preoccupied for conversation. She hummed to herself, swigged brandy. She leaned constantly forward to peer out of the windows, as if she were hunting an address, or I decided taking a last impression of a scene she wanted to remember. It was neither of these.
"Stop here," she ordered the driver.
And we pulled to the curb of a street in Spanish Harlem. Holly stepped out of the car. She took the cat with her. Cradling him, she scratched his head and asked,
"What do you think? This ought to be the right kind of place for a tough guy like you, hmm? Garbage cans, rats galore, so scram,"
she said, dropping him. And when he did not move away, instead raised his thug face and questioned her with yellowish pirate eyes, she stamped her foot.
"I said beat it!"
He rubbed against her leg.
"I said, F off!"
she shouted, then jumped back in the car, slammed the door,
and "Go!" she told the driver. "Go, go!"
I was stunned. "Well, you are. You are a bitch." We'd traveled a block before she replied.
"I told you, we just met by the river one day. That's all. Independence, both of us. We never made each other any promises. We never..."
she said, and her voice collapsed. A tick, an invalid whiteness, seized her face. The car had paused for a traffic light. Then she had the door open. She was running down the street, and I ran after her. But the cat was not at the corner where he'd been left. There was no one, nothing on the street except a urinating drunk and 2 Negro nuns herding a file of sweet-singing children. Other children emerged from doors, and ladies leaned over their window sills to watch as Holly ran back and forth, chanting,
"You, cat, Where are you? Here, Cat.
The limousine had followed us. At the door, she hesitated, and she shuddered.
Oh, God. We did belong to each other. He was mine.
Then I made her a promise. I'd come back and find her cat. I'll take care of him, too, I promise. She smiled. That cheerless new pinch of a smile.
But what about me? She whispered. I'm very scared, Buster. Yes. At last, because it could go on forever. Not knowing what's yours until you've thrown it away. The mean reds, they're nothing. The fat woman, she's nothing. This, though, my mouth's so dry. If my life depended on it, I couldn't spit.
She stepped into the car, sank in the seat.
Sorry, driver. Let's go.
Tomatoes, tomato, missing. And drug case actress believed gangland victim. In due time, however, the press reported fleeing playgirl traced to Rio. Apparently no attempt was made by American authorities to recover her, and soon the matter diminished to an occasional gossip column mention. As a news story, it was revived only once on Christmas Day, when Sally Tomato died of a heart attack at Sing Sing. Months went by, a winter of them, and not a word from Holly. The owner of the brownstone sold her abandoned possessions. A new tenant acquired the apartment. But in the spring, a postcard came. It was scribbled in pencil and signed with a lipstick kiss. Brazil was beastly, but Buenos Aires is the best. Not Tiffany's, but almost. Am joined at the hip with divine senor. Love? Think so. Anyhow, am looking for somewhere to live. Senor has wife, 7 brats. Am will let you know address when I know it myself. Mille tendresse. But the address, if it ever existed, never was sent. Which made me sad. There was so much I wanted to write her. That I had sold 2 stories. Had read where the Trawlers were countersuing for divorce. Was moving out of the brownstone because it was haunted. But mostly, I wanted to tell her about the cat. I had kept my promise. I had found him. It took 2 weeks of after-work roaming through those Spanish Harlem streets, and there were many false alarms, flashes of tiger-striped fur that, upon inspection, were not him. But one day, one cold, sunshiny Sunday winter afternoon, it was. Flanked by potted plants and framed by clean lace curtains, he was seated in the window of a warm-looking room. I wondered what his name was, for I was certain he had one now. Certain he'd arrived somewhere he belonged. African hut, or whatever. I hope Holly has, too.
Breakfast at Tiffany's by Truman Capote was read by Henry Goodman, abridged by James Robertson, and produced by Bruce Young.